Today, we're going to treat the Soviet school. When I first began to lecture on this topic, it was called the Soviet school, but then the Soviet Empire disappeared, so perhaps it will eventually be called the Russian school. And I'm going to give a brief intellectual background to the Soviet-Russian school, but focus most of my remarks on Vygotsky, who is the key figure for developmental psychology from the Soviet school. In Russia, which was then the name of the country in the 19th century, scientific interest in psychology grew out of an area which we call reflexology. Reflexology is the study of very basic forms of behavior, such as reflexes. You know, when the doctor hits your shin and your leg pops up, that's a reflex. And if you take an infant and scratch the side of his or her lips, tongue will come over and perhaps try to grasp your finger. And this was seen by scientists of the period, in other countries as well, as perhaps the basic unit which was to think about behavior, namely that you have a physical system, and when the system is stimulated in a certain way, it responds, and the simplest kind of response is a reflex. Pavlov is the most famous scientist who grew out of the reflexology tradition. Sekhanov and Bekhterev are other ones. And Pavlov is best known in psychology because he was the individual who realized that you have both unconditioned and conditioned responses. And the classic example from Pavlov was that if you ring a bell at the same time that you present a piece of meat to a dog, that eventually the bell will become a conditioned stimulus. That means that you no longer have to present the meat anymore. If you simply ring the bell, the dog will salivate. So that's a conditioned stimulus and a conditioned response, as opposed to the unconditioned stimulus and response, which is if you put a piece of meat in front of a canine, it will salivate without any particular instructions to do so. Pavlov, who actually won a Nobel Prize for physiology before he went into psychology, also described what he called second signal systems. And these were signal systems like the one that I'm using now, like language. I can actually just refer to a bell, which in turn can designate in your mind a piece of meat. And if I simply say the word bell now, probably those of you who like meat will salivate. Those of you who don't like meat will just get annoyed, though perhaps some of you may do both. But these are all because of signal systems, which we obviously didn't have initially in our biological makeup, but we can learn to give the same reaction simply to words or pictures that at an earlier time or in lower species could only be evoked by the actual piece of meat itself. The political revolution that occurred in 1917, the Marxist-Leninist or Soviet revolution, had tremendous impact on that whole country, impact that we're still seeing today. The revolution itself lasted some 70 years, close to 70 years, and ended in our lifetime, either with the bringing down of the Berlin Wall or the actual end of the Gorbachev regime and the beginning of the Yeltsin regime in the early 90s. The Soviet period has such a bad press in the West, and for that matter probably in most of contemporary Russia as well, that it's hard to appreciate it. At the time, it was a very exciting movement, just like the Russian, just like the French Revolution or the American Revolution. People felt they were overthrowing tyrants, they were getting rid of chains. This was going to be a revolution, the first in the world, which gave power to all the people. It was a self-styled populist revolution. I don't have to go through what happened in the succeeding years. It wasn't a very happy story. But many intellectuals and artists were very excited by the Leninist regime of the 1920s because they felt they had a lot of license to pursue things which interested them in their own way. And the people who I'm going to talk about today, Vygotsky and Luria, two young Jewish males who were just at the end of their adolescence when the Soviet Revolution broke out, were extremely energized by this intellectual movement, and they thought it would allow them to create a new kind of science, including a new science of psychology. I like in this context to tell an anecdote about one of the intellectuals of this period, whom many of you will know, the Russian-Soviet film director Serge Eisenstein, who made films like The Battleship Potemkin and Alexander Nevsky, which were Ivan the Terrible, which were initially well-received until Stalin realized that he was really Ivan the Terrible, and then he put Eisenstein under house arrest for the rest of his life. I went to an exhibition in honor of Eisenstein 10 or 15 years ago at a British museum, and there they actually had recreated his study at the time where he was about to die. He died of a heart attack about 1948. This was the very worst time of the Soviet period when Stalin was busy killing everybody, and artists and Jews were particular favorite targets of his. And Eisenstein had on his wall photographs of people whom he admired, like Charlie Chaplin and James Joyce, great intellectual figures of the period whom he may well have met because he was allowed to travel around Europe during the late 1920s. But what I found absolutely unbelievable in looking at this recreation of Eisenstein's study was that he was taking notes in 1948 of a book that had been published in 1947 in the University of Chicago Press called Painting and Personality, which looked at paintings by young kids and attempt to analyze the emotional states of the kids who produced these paintings. The text was, of course, in English. Eisenstein clearly was able to read English. He was taking notes. I forget whether they were English or Russian, but they were notes about the meanings of different colors in the children's paintings of that period. The reason this absolutely blew my mind was to think, here's somebody living essentially incarcerated in the Soviet Union at the worst time, surrounded by the icons that he admired, and actually had somehow gotten hold of a book in English from psychology, a book that probably nobody who listens to this lecture will ever have heard of, long since out of print, which analyzed, as it were, the connotation of colors for little kids, and clearly this artist was trying to understand how colors work on all of us. And the thought that at the one time people like Eisenstein or Vygotsky or Luria, all of whom suffered real pain under the Soviet Revolution, would do everything to keep their minds alive and would continue to live, as it were, on the plane of intellect, irrespective of what was happening to their body and their freedom and their professional options, is to me very stirring and a reminder that freedom and democracy are chiefly appreciated in places which can't take them for granted, like most of us do. One other aspect of the intellectual background to keep in mind is that in the 19th century, there was a bitter intellectual battle in Russia, I think more bitter than in other places, between what was called materialism and idealism. Materialism basically believes that everything has a concrete physical cause, and you're best off when you're trying to understand something to look for that physicality. And reflexology would be a typical example of materialism. If you want to understand behavior, don't worry about mentalistic constructs, about ideas, about spirit, anything like that. Look at what happens to the body when it's stimulated. Look at how reflexes work physiologically. Look at how they work in the brain, the nerve response to a nerve stimulus, and that's the right way to go. On the other hand, there was an equally strong perspective with deep roots in the Russian Orthodox Church and in art and literature for a belief in idealism or spirituality, namely that human beings are a species apart. What's important are our sentiments, our feelings, our thoughts. These things are by their very nature immaterial, and the best way to understand them is as ideas in an idealistic, spiritual fashion, things existing on the plane of thought, with materiality really not being anything that one should pay attention to when it comes to human enterprise. And those of you who've read Russian novels like Dostoevsky or Russian playwrights like Chekhov or short story writers like Turgenev will see often debates among protagonists where they take idealist versus materialistic positions, and of course they can't both be right, but it's a very bloody interchange. And the background of Vygotsky, who we're going to focus on today, is that he was trying to forge a middle ground between the people who said it's all in the reflexes, or nowadays, like we say, it's all in the genes, and the people who said, forget the material substrate, forget the physicality. What's important about us are our minds, our spirits, our beliefs, our loves, and you've got to analyze things on that ideal level, as it were, a Hegelian level. Remember that Hegel was a great believer in the world spirit, and Marx claimed that he turned Hegel upside down by finding a material basis for the state and the economy, things which Hegel explored in an idealistic way. And you can see Vygotsky, who, unlike Luria, really knew his Marx, knew it from beginning to end, was trying to mediate between a materialist position and an idealist position, the same kind of debate that you see going on between Hegel and Marx. Those of you who have a memory for dates will recognize that Vygotsky was born in exactly the same year as Piaget. Well, obviously that's a coincidence in certain ways, except if you realize that they were both Europeans growing up in a intellectual environment around the early part of the century, then perhaps it's not so surprising. We might say two generations after Darwin that young people interested in the mind and the behavior, those being the twin roots of psychology, would try to become developmentalists and would try to think about how do you play Darwin with reference to human intellectual development. So anyway, they were age mates. Piaget was even more precocious than Vygotsky, though they were both incredibly precocious. So when Vygotsky was a student, he read Piaget, Piaget already being published in his 20s and world famous in his 30s. And Vygotsky, in a lot of his writing, attacked Piaget while paying homage to him at the same time. Vygotsky and Luria, his friend, also read Freud at that time. They were reading Piaget and Freud, who were the folks to read, just like maybe nowadays people read Steve Gould and Steve Pinker. Those days they read Freud and Piaget, both of whom were still alive. In fact, even Freud outlived Vygotsky. Vygotsky died of tuberculosis and no doubt of being abused a lot when he was still in his 30s. Trying to characterize Vygotsky versus Piaget, let me propose that Vygotsky and Piaget were both geniuses. Vygotsky stood out because of his breadth and his intuition. He had amazingly wide knowledge. He didn't become a psychologist until he was 30. He was basically an esthetician. I think he also had a law degree. So he was very, very versatile, knew about even more than Piaget did, and was brilliantly intuitive. He could go into an area of confusion, figure out what the arguments were, and put forth a very profound intuition. Intuition means he often didn't have any evidence, but he had very powerful intuitions. And you see, he left 80 unpublished manuscripts when he died. He would lecture in Moscow. Everybody would come to hear him. People would sit there and take notes. And of course, he died without publishing it. I don't know that he ever published any book except a book about psychology of art, though now there are many books which bear his name. That's the nature of marketing. But every week he would take on a new subject and he would just get right to the core. It's absolutely dazzling. That's why I use the term Mozart, which I borrow from Stephen Tolman, who called Vygotsky the Mozart of Russian Soviet psychology, and Luria the Beethoven. Beethoven, having lived longer, come after Mozart, kind of picked up the pieces and put them together in a way that other people could make sense of them. And Piaget, I would call brilliant as a systematizer, putting things together in a very neat system, and also as an observer. Piaget really saw things in kids which nobody saw before, and once he saw them, other people did. There's no particular evidence that Vygotsky spent a lot of time looking at kids. Whenever he talks about experiments, they're things which other people did. So he's basically somebody who sits back and synthesizes it, not systematizes it, but synthesizes it and figures out what it might mean. Very interesting, contrasting figures. I should mention, too, that while Vygotsky attacked Piaget in his writing, Piaget had no idea of this. Vygotsky died. It was all in Russian. Only 30 years later, when Vygotsky was translated into English and probably into French as well, though Piaget could read English, Piaget saw what a brilliant man Vygotsky had been, politely expressed regret that he had died so prematurely, and then answered Vygotsky in an introduction to the book Thought and Language, which appears in some editions, but not, unfortunately, in any of the editions which are currently available. Vygotsky was a polymath, and his articles give hints of what he thought, but other people have to put together those hints. It's as if Mozart had left the opening lines of many pieces and other people had to complete them. Even though Vygotsky was a convinced Marxist and believed in reflexes and believed in physiology and believed in the material basis, everything came from us as being physical and physiological beings, he said reflexes aren't enough. If you want to understand human beings, you can't ignore what's distinctive about them. You have to look at mental processes, the arts in which he had a particular interest, painting, literature, poetry, and consciousness, which is the most distinctive and unique characteristic of human beings. And he obviously felt that you couldn't simply go from reflexes all the way up to these things. It required a new enterprise, in fact, a developmental enterprise. Vygotsky is really a developmental psychologist with the word development emphasized. He thought the only way one could understand these, as it were, higher acquisitions of human beings was to be a developmentalist through and through and see how they arose over many years from more purely physiological kinds of capacities. The other point about Vygotsky, which came up last time when we spoke about Piaget and the post-Piagetians, is that Vygotsky figured out very early on, and he got this from Marx, but he was the one who made a lot out of it, that a key to the intellect of the developing human being were various kinds of tools which the society had created. Physical tools, like levers and seesaws and hammers and screwdrivers and things like that, and what we call notational tools, various kinds of symbol systems. And these tools, which are, at least in the former case, quite material, are things which the child first learns to use with other people, then learns to use by him or herself, and then learns to operate in the head without having to necessarily depend upon the physical tools. But these physical tools become our tools for thinking, quote unquote, and that's what leads to human consciousness. And even though Vygotsky didn't use the word constructivist, he clearly is a constructivist in the sense that he doesn't believe anything gets impressed in our mind-brain simply because it's in the environment. We have to invent our meanings, invent our worlds. But unlike Piaget, he recognizes much more the role of the social environment of other human beings and the role of the man-made environment, various tools and artifacts, in helping us to construct that world. What I'm going to do for the bulk of the lecture is to run through 10 tenets. These are by no means the only 10 things one could say about Vygotsky. As I said, he left over 80 unpublished papers and dozens of published papers. But what I'm trying to do here is basically point fingers at things which I think are very important, which I think are distinctive about Vygotsky, which often have an educational implication, and the hope is that you will read through the books that have now been published under his names and the collections that have been published under his name to get the fine text of each of these tenets. Number one, as I just mentioned, Vygotsky was a committed developmentalist. He made a big deal about development. He very much favored the genetic method, which meant for him that for any adult behavior, what we might call for any adult end state, you have to look at how it develops and evolves over time, meaning over long time, over many, many years. And whatever the ability was, whether it was speaking, writing, solving problems, finding your way around, whatever the particular interesting topic was Vygotsky said, look at how the young child does this sort of thing and see how it changes over time. What are the different functions that it fulfills en route from being a very primitive, elementary, even reflexive behavior to one that's very sophisticated? I think actually the best example is not speech, it's writing. If you put a pencil in the hand of a 1 or 2 year old, the 1 or 2 year old will reflexively grasp it. And as soon as it realizes it can make marks, it'll move its finger back and forth. We could say that was writing. But it's certainly not writing in the same sense as a 3 or 4 year old who will try to copy something, who will try to draw something, and who will not have distinguished between drawing and writing. It's different from what a 5 or 6 year old will do, which is beginning to learn letters and to know the difference between drawing an object and writing a letter or writing a word. It's different from the 8 or 9 year old who, if you say a word to the child, can write the word out, but who doesn't really know how to compose a sentence, let alone a story. It's different from the 12 or 13 year old who does his or her homework with effort, but still basically knows how to take what they're thinking or saying and putting it into writing. And it's different from what adults do, where, as I mentioned in discussing David Olson, writing becomes a vehicle for thinking, and many of us can't even think without having a pen or word processor in our hands. So we might say there the writing is pushing our thinking rather than the writing being a very poor imitation, a pale imitation of our thinking, which is what happens if we're 10 or 12 years of age. So I've taken one behavior, namely writing, and shown how objectively the same thing, namely grabbing a writing implement and making some marks on the paper, changes its function totally over the course of the first 20 years of life. When Vygotsky talked about lower or higher functions, what he meant is initially when you put a pen or pencil in somebody's hand, it's fulfilling a very simple function like grasping or making a mark or maybe imitating. We still are able to do those things, but if you are grasping a pen in order to, say, kill a fly or make a mark in a painting, it's a very different use than the reason that you initially were able to grab a pen. And similarly, if you're copying something, it's because you have a real reason for wanting to copy it, like you want to imitate somebody's handwriting, and not because that's the only thing that you know how to do when you see a model in front of you. So the lower functions don't disappear. They go underground. But when you need to do something which requires grasping or copying or writing something where you don't know the meaning, you don't care about the meaning, you can still do those things, but usually you have a higher purpose for doing that. When Vygotsky says that all higher mental functions appear first in an intrapsychological plane, he's making the point that people do not use language, they don't problem solve, they don't puzzle about things using only their own devices, which is sort of the implication of Piaget's perspective. Rather, initially, these things like thinking, writing, reading, problem solving, puzzling, occur because other people in the society are doing it. The child first observes, then gets drawn in, usually at a very simple level, like hearing somebody else read or watching somebody else write and maybe dotting the I's or crossing the T's. But eventually, as the child gets drawn further and further into this conversation, so to speak, the child assumes more and more of the modeled behavior. The child becomes able on his or her own to do more of the thinking or the reading or the writing or the problem solving or the puzzling. And eventually, the support of others, the notational support, the human support can fade away, and the child can do these things essentially by himself or herself. I'm lecturing now. I have some notes, but basically I'm doing it without a lot of support. Yet, it would be absurd to think that I ever could have lectured or done anything like this on my own. I've had to watch many people lecture over the years, listen to what it's like, lectured very poorly for many years, got input, scaffolding, as we will say, from other people. And eventually, this thing, which was learned initially by interactions with other people, becomes something that's more and more of my own. We all read on our own, and most of us can read critically. We can argue with the text, we can put exclamation points or no or underline yellow or do various kinds of things. All those things we do ourselves initially, we did because other people did it, and we realized that reading wasn't just something one did orally without knowing the meaning, nor was it something one did passively by just sort of hoping that we could make sense of it if we read it over and over again. But that reading is a very active process where we're constantly organizing and arguing and agreeing and puzzling about things. But none of that happens initially. None of it happens for free. These are long-term inventions by other human beings, which we eventually get to do more on our own. Third point, it's already emphasized, Vygotsky, honoring his Marxist background, was very interested in tools, extensions of human beings, things which make us stronger, like a lever, or more powerful, or able to deal with something smaller, or something far away. Those are all tools, as well as tools which are more in the terms of notations, written tools, maps, graphs, things like that. All of these things were not invented by us. It probably took thousands of years to invent print, and even tools that we take totally for granted were invented over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. These tools are things which already exist in our surrounding, and we're introduced to them. And the more facile we are, the more we can take those tools and use them ourselves for our own purposes. They're mediators. They allow us to do things to the external world or our own mind which we couldn't do without those tools. And as Vygotsky emphasizes, and here he would be in agreement with Piaget and most other developmentalists, is initially we use tools in only one way. I'm a great example of that in computers, since I don't really understand the softwares with any depth. I'm very good at using something in one way, but if I have to use a function in a new way, or I have to figure out how to accomplish something where I don't know the function, that's very difficult for me. I usually scream for help, and sometimes when I use it enough, I can use it more flexibly. Also, when there's no one around to help me, then I have to figure it out on my own, and sometimes I actually succeed in doing so, but it's by analogy with other things which I learned because other people showed me how to do it. The more developed you are, the less you need the supporting context, the more you can use these things in many, many different kinds of ways. Moving along, Vygotsky had a very interesting perspective on the twin roots of language. He pointed out that kids certainly make sounds before they have language. They babble. They also use single words in very approximate kind of ways, like papa dealing with any male or any grown adult. And clearly, we also are able to think before we have language. Kids can get things that they want. They can go exploring for stuff that's hidden. And all sorts of animals are engaged in problem solving, even though they don't have any kind of language or speech. So you've got these two separate streams which are developing in the first 12 to 18 months of life. But language really congeals when the capacity to make sounds and to hear sounds combines with the capacity to think, to problem solve. It's when the verbal production or the oral production of the parrot meets the problem solving capacity of the primate that you've got language. And language is powerful because it's a very neat tool which can capture things which are important, like meanings that we value. And word meaning for Vygotsky was incredibly important. He saw the meaning of words as the place where the sounds of language and where non-linguistic thinking came together. Word meaning, however, is anything but a simple thing. I said that dada or papa can mean all males or any big person. By the time kids are three or four, they know what papa means, but what father means is confusing, not only because we may not be sure who one's father is, and the word father is used for ministers who aren't supposed to have, for priests who aren't supposed to have children. And that's a simple word when you think about a word like creature or animal or democracy or revolution or developmental psychology. These are incredibly difficult words. To give them meaning is something most of us can't do. We have to look them up in dictionaries. And that's just the literal meaning. There's also the connotation of a word. If I say cheese, that's got a definite connotation for you, depending whether you like or don't like cheese. And people who know a lot about cheese say that the connotation of fromage in French or formaggio in Italian or käse in German is different than the connotation of cheese because we associate different cheeses with those different lands. Vygotsky, in fact, went so far as to claim that one could trace the whole development of conceptual thinking by looking at the way the understanding of word meaning developed, and he had some ways of looking at that. And he also said that word meaning was the unit of consciousness. By that he meant, if we want to think about what consciousness is, we can probably get closest to it if we think about what it takes in us as human beings to appreciate a meaning like cheese or democracy or something like that. It's the vessel, so to speak, in which we can capture consciousness, with the implication that without language we couldn't be conscious. Language is the language, and the meaning of words is the territory in which consciousness lives. So that's a very ambitious program. I think it's a brilliant intuition, and a brilliant intuition is both a word of praise but also a word of caution. As you can tell with my own struggling, it's not exactly clear how big word meaning is supposed to be and exactly clear how it relates to consciousness, but it's also clear that Vygotsky's on to something. He isn't just, as we used to say, whistling Dixie. The argument that Vygotsky had with early Piaget was about what Piaget called egocentric speech. Piaget noticed, as many people have, that kids who are 3 or 4 do a lot of talking to themselves. They mutter. And they may mutter when there's a group around, they may mutter when there's alone. And as was typical with Piaget, he thought this was a dysfunctional thing. Kind of like play was dysfunctional. It's stuff that kids did because they were immature, but if they got mature, they'd stop playing and they'd stop muttering to themselves. He called it egocentric because for him it implied the child was autistic, the child was in his own world. He didn't realize that other people were there, couldn't understand what he was talking about, didn't care, would have been annoyed, that sort of thing. So he gave a very critical view of egocentric speech. Vygotsky said, Jean Piaget, you're all wrong. As a developmentalist, a geneticist, I think that this egocentric speech, as you call it, is very important. It's very functional. It has a real purpose. The purpose is partly to have contact with other people, and it's partly to help you solve a problem. It's what he called a transitional form in between language, which was purely imitative on the part of child, and thinking, which could take place without language completely internally. And here's a place where Vygotsky actually did some experiments. He showed that he could manipulate the incidence of egocentric speech depending upon the context. This shouldn't be true if Piaget is right. If the kid's just muttering to himself, he ought to mutter to himself no matter what's going on or what's around. But Vygotsky showed, first of all, if you gave a child a simple task, he'd be much less likely to mutter than if you gave him a more complex task. And listen to the muttering, the child was talking to himself. He was telling himself how to do that. Oh, you got to put this over here first. You got to open this up. You got to align these things. He was talking. I'm being more fancy than the child, but he was talking to himself and telling himself what to do, the way you may tell yourself what to do when you're worried about something or you don't have it quite right. Also, Vygotsky cleverly showed that kids had less egocentric speech if the people in the room were people whom they couldn't talk to, either because the people were hard of hearing or because the people only spoke a foreign language. So this showed two functions. One, the child used less of this language if there was no chance of being able to talk to other people. He also used less of this language if he didn't need to help him solve problems. So I think that Vygotsky, you might say, had Piaget on this particular measure, that Piaget's description of autistic or egocentric speech was too simplistic, and that's because Piaget didn't pay enough attention to the constitutive role of other people in making the mind of the young child. Vygotsky also had a quite brilliant analysis of play. Again, like Piaget, though I don't recall that he particularly attacked Piaget. In fact, he wouldn't have, because Piaget's book on play only came out almost a decade after Vygotsky died. So if I'd said that he was criticizing Piaget on play, you could have caught me on that rather handily. Anyway, what Vygotsky said is play is very important. It really is, so to speak, the advance guard for a child's thinking. Indeed, kids are more sophisticated in play than they are in, so-unquote, real life. And he said we can play roles which we're trying to understand, and in trying to understand those roles, we actually pull our development along. I mean, it's a wonderful example of these two sisters who say, let's play at being sisters. And in the act of playing at being sisters, they actually highlight what it means to be a sister in much more of a way than they do without playing. In other words, in their actual everyday play with one another. Because when they say play sister, this calls attention to what it is that's distinctive about a sister, say, and distinguish it from playing it with yourself or playing with somebody whom you didn't know well the way you would know your sister. What Vygotsky points out is that in play you often start off simply exploring an element, like let's say exploring a stick. But then when you begin to treat the stick as a hobby horse, something to hop on, or a stick as a baseball bat or as a golf club or as a shaving implement or so on, then your behavior becomes much more elaborate, because it isn't just, we might say, the reflex or the physical property of the object that's dictating what you do. It's the meaning. It's the fact that you can assert, oh, this thing which I know deep down is just a stick is functioning now as an artifact of play or a way of taking care of your physical condition, or as a way of getting around if it's functioning as a hobby horse. So you have, for the young child, the physical attributes dominate and the meaning is secondary, and that flips over in the developmental genetic lower functions become higher functions point of view, where the meaning that you impose on something predominates, and then anything can become a horse. In fact, it can be completely imaginary. You can hop around without a stick at all. But as the point here says, the imagination itself becomes rule governed, and there are certain things that you will or won't do with the imaginary horse, because it's horsehood or horse ability that's dictating what you're doing in your mind. And any of you who've ever seen Marcel Marceau, the great mime, will know that even in the absence of any objects at all, you can create a whole world, and the world can have quite strict constraints. Otherwise, nobody who looked at Marcel Marceau going like this or like this would have any idea of what he was doing. It's his ability to create a world and have the meaning of that world predominate over the pure physical actions. Four more to go. Much more so than Piaget, Vygotsky really worried about the use of developmental psychology for educational purposes. This, I think, was part of the message of the Soviet Revolution, is you weren't supposed to be interested in science for its own sake. That would be called bourgeois science. You should be interested in science for what it could teach you about how to help people, and that's a perfectly respectable mission. We wouldn't be in this school teaching this course if we didn't think that understanding human development would have educational ramifications. And Vygotsky developed a number of concepts, or proposed a number of concepts, which are very often talked about in educational circles. There are probably almost no courses in human development psychology which don't talk about ZPD and dialogical learning and scaffolding, which doesn't mean I won't say a word about each. ZPD stands for the zone for proximal development. It's a very clever concept that Vygotsky had. He said that we should be interested not only in what kids can do when they have no help at all, kind of a Piaget condition, so to speak, but what they can do to provide some help, what he calls some scaffolding. Scaffolding means another person, or could be a machine, gives you some hints or some models to help you accomplish something that you want to accomplish. And what he pointed out, this was the, I think, the brilliant insight, is you could have two kids who do exactly the same, say, in an IQ test. So you think you're equally smart, if you believe in IQ tests. But then you provide a little help for some of the items. And you find that one child's performance zooms up. The other child's performance is just marginally better. The first child has a larger zone of proximal development. This basically means, given only a certain amount of help or modeling or cues, this guy gets much better, or this gal gets much better. So the potential is much greater. In that sense, that child, I think it was the first child, is smarter than the second one, who needs a lot of support to get further at all. Dialogical learning is recognition of the fact that so much of what we learn occurs initially by talking to other people, by seeing their response to us, by essentially having a public conversation. And as we get older and more developed, we can have a conversation within our own head. One example I often use is the example of editing. When I initially wrote stuff, it was typically rejected, and was rejected with very critical comments. I still get things rejected, but not as often. And one reason not is because the conversation I would have had to have overtly with the editor over a long period of time, since there was no email in those days, I can now have inside my head, and I can say, what would somebody think of this? And I can do the external dialogue mentally. And any of us who's ever had to have a difficult conversation with somebody, and I can't believe anybody has survived to take this course without having had difficult conversation with someone, is you often anticipate in your own mind by playing both roles. And the better you know the person, the more you can play that role. We'll come back to that at number 10. Speaking about education, let me skip to number 9, because one of the most interesting issues that Vygotsky wrote about, well, I guess I shouldn't actually, because I'm going to redo this and simply go to number 8, concepts. Concept is a psychologist's word for the classification which we make of the world. We parse the world or classify the world in terms of what we call concepts. So the world of psychology is composed of concepts like the reflex, a developmental stage, a concept of intelligence, concept of motivation, and so on. Those are concepts. We capture them in words, but you could have a concept of intelligence or motivation without putting it in the same words, or without even putting it in words at all. Certainly, kids understand about motivation long before they have the word motivation, so they've got the concept before they have the word. So every psychologist since the turn of the century has been interested in concepts, because they basically are the furniture of the mind. We think in concepts. Vygotsky was no different. He thought that concepts are very important. And again, he invented an ingenious approach for studying concepts, which we now call Vygotsky blocks. These were simple three-dimensional geometrical forms that looked like cylinders or cones or rectangles or cubes. And he would give people a bunch of these forms, and he would then give arbitrary names to these forms, words which didn't exist in the language, like B-I-K or Z-O-N or L-U-F or things like that. And the job of the subject would be to figure out what was the definition of B-I-C or whatever the particular nonsense syllable was. And the only clue would be, if you applied the term to a particular object, you would be told this is or isn't a BIC or a LUF or whatever the word was. And naturally, this can be made very simple if either every object has its own name, or there are only two words and one stands for black and one stands for white. But this becomes more interesting when the word BIC refers, say, to a small cylinder or a tall rectangle. That's a very complicated disjunctive definition of a geometric form, because it can be A or B or both. Though I don't see how it could be both in this particular case. So anyway, using this approach of arbitrary labels applied to a clearly definable set of entities, namely objects with clear geometries, this was a very clever technique of getting at how individuals form concepts. And of course, anybody involved in this game at a particular historical time gets somewhat better, but Vygotsky was much more interested in how three-year-olds would approach this, how six-year-olds, how 12-year-olds, and how adults would approach this particular task of concept formation. Concept formation was also a very valuable lens onto word meaning, because really you're looking at what the meaning of the word thick is. And initially, if you play the game, maybe you apply the word thick to anything which is round. But then when you found it also applies to a square thing, to a rectilinear thing, it's got to be round or rectilinear, so maybe it's size, or maybe it's color, or maybe it's one of those difficult disjoint concepts. So the meaning of the word thick is changing as you're getting feedback on whether you're applying that label correctly or incorrectly. I have Aristotle and Wittgenstein here because they represent the two polar means of thinking about concepts. For Aristotle, and for people who are of a certain logical disposition, concepts have quite clear definitions, like a bachelor is an unmarried male. And when you have that definition, you know what the thing is. And if you don't, you don't. And the Vygotsky blocks are really in the Aristotelian tradition, namely something is or isn't a bic. The bic has a definition, even though the definition may be complicated. It's a set of logical criteria which a bic has to follow, or the word bachelor has to follow. Most people now don't believe that this Aristotelian Vygotskian view of concepts is correct. They follow a Wittgensteinian view, which basically says that concepts are words or ideas which have a family relationship to one another, and that you can't come up with a strict definition of what is or isn't most entities. And Wittgenstein's favorite example was the concept game. There's no way you can come up with a definition of what a game is. Game has got a very blurry boundaries. Clearly chess is a game, and probably assassination is not a game, unless you're playing a video game. But there are lots of things where is it a game is a matter of opinion. If people are in love and they're flirting with each other, is that a game? It might be, it might not. In order to stay awake in the lecture, I see how long I can hold my breath, is that a game? Well, maybe, maybe not. But most concepts, Wittgenstein argued, and most people now follow him, don't have these clear-cut definitions of either it is or it isn't a bic or a bachelor or a father, even. Even father, we often use the word father not just to refer to the paternal person of the older generation, but in a more general notion as well. Nonetheless, even if Vygotsky's particular philosophical interpretation of concepts is not one that we would accept today, this way of looking at how kids of different age try to understand BIC, or to use a more regular word, table, or a regular word, democracy, and to look at it developmentally and see how kids sort and when they will or won't use that word is a very powerful kind of lens on conceptual development. For anybody interested in the academy, conceptual development is sort of the name of the game. I have two other cues there. The first cue, decontextualization, basically means that initially most of us learn concepts only in certain contexts, like I was talking about the meaning of a computer command, and I only use that computer command under one condition. But eventually, as we get to know it better, we can use that concept much more flexibly. We can use it in many, many different situations. It becomes decontextualized or much, much more flexible. Fodor, who is a philosopher who we will talk about when we talk about the modular view of the mind, was very critical of the whole Vygotskian approach to concept formation. And I think his critique is interesting, though ultimately it has an absurd quality to it. And here's the critique. The critique goes like this. It says, you can't come up with the meaning of the concept unless you throw out a speculation for what the concept would mean. And if you're able to throw out the notion of what the concept means, you already have that concept. You already have that set of notions. And so in a sense, conceptual development is an inherently meaningless enterprise. Let me try that one more time. Let's say you run into a new concept. We'll call that concept disintegration. And you think you don't know what it means. However, you keep guessing what it means, and eventually you're going to get more or less right. And if you were able to guess more or less right, you have to have that concept or you wouldn't be able to make that guess. So what Fodor ends up concluding, which is what is absurd about it, and he knows it's absurd, is that we're born knowing all concepts. Because we didn't already know them all at birth, we could never come up with them. So anyway, that's something for you to think about as you walk home this afternoon. It's called Plato's problem, one of many Plato problems, because the issue is, if it wasn't there in the first place, how could we ever get it? And that's a very deep philosophical problem. Developmental psychology is a sustained argument against this point of view. If it's all there, there's no such thing as development. Development is very trivial. And both Fodor and his teacher Chomsky basically believe development is very trivial, which is why we don't worship them here in the human development and psychology faculty. Another very interesting point raised, perhaps really for the first time in any detail in developmental psychology, was the relationship between scientific and spontaneous concepts. Vygotsky wrote very provocatively about this. He didn't solve it, but he put the question on the map. And a lot of my own writing in books like The Unschooled Mind and Disciplined Mind have been efforts to relate scientific to spontaneous concepts. Spontaneous concepts are basically concepts that you meet on the street. It's things that everybody runs into because we live and we talk to other people and we go to the store and we chop wood and we play tiddlywinks and things like that. So they're concepts which you pick up just by living in a society. And everybody who isn't grossly abnormal has thousands of spontaneous concepts. Scientific concepts, which may have has perhaps academic would be a better word, are things we would never run into if we didn't go to school. You'd never run into developmental psychology or stages or motivation or genetics or heritability or intelligent quotient if you didn't go to school. They're school topics. They're topics which academics created as part of doing science or history or literature or some other academic subject. Clearly, you don't have to go to school to learn spontaneous concepts. You go to school to learn scientific concepts. And so the big question is, what's the relationship between scientific and spontaneous concepts? According to Vygotsky, Piaget would have taken the view that there's only one way to learn concepts, by constructing them. It doesn't make any difference whether you meet them in the street or you meet them in school, you've got to do it the same way. So it's not a real problem for Piaget. Another perspective would be that they're entirely two different things. One, you don't have to go to school. They're present in all unschooled societies and all preliterate cultures. The other is a very particular school thing. It only happens if it's a teacher and textbooks and lectures. And so it's like two different universes. If you realize that Vygotsky has an intellectual style, it's a dialectic Marxist-Leninist-Hegelian style, he's always going to create something which says they're neither totally different nor totally the same. Rather, they're two planes, planes, which will be brought in contact with each other in various ways. They're not the same, but they're not totally different. And he uses this, as it were, visual metaphor that scientific concepts are up here, and the challenge for them is to bring them in contact with everyday natural experience. Spontaneous concepts are down here, like, let's say, family or father. We all have those spontaneous concepts. But if we're learning about kinship or about strict definitions of what a father or a bachelor is, we've got to bring them up to contact with the scientific concepts. So two different planes, but interacting dialectically, and each proceeds in a different direction. The scientific concepts, we can learn to bandy them around in school, but unless we relate them to our everyday experience, they don't really have any meaning. They're just what Whitehead would call inert knowledge. Similarly, spontaneous concepts are fine unless you want to be precise about something, and unless you want to relate it to what other people have studied and understood, in which case you have to take words that you may have heard, like freedom, say, or liberty, you hear them in the street, and you've got to give them a more of a scientific or defined basis. Another interesting observation of Vygotsky's was that it's often easier to learn about scientific concepts if you don't use examples that are too close to home. So let's say you're learning about a social system. He says it's better to study a social system in a very remote group like the Natsilik Eskimo, or if you're in Russia, a plantation in the south of the United States, than it is to study the social system close to home. Because a social system close to home is too filled with connotations and associations which are really irrelevant, except the post office or the church have very definite meanings for you physically and emotionally and so on. So certain things are best approached from remote examples where your own rich contextual connotation doesn't get in the way. And I think that's a very provocative idea. The final one of the tenets that I've already referred to is the great importance that Vygotsky places on word meaning. And as I said, he said, if you want to understand what consciousness is, the best unit to look at is the way that words mean. And I'm going to give you an example which I find very moving from Vygotsky's writing. It occurs at the end of Language and Thought, or Thought and Language, depending on which edition you have. And it shows you about the context, about the connection between overt language or speech, in this case written language, and the deep feelings that people have which give rise to language and which allow us to make sense of language. And this is a conversation between two characters in Anna Karenina at the very end, Kitty and her would-be lover Levin, who is dying. And Levin says to Kitty as he's dying, "I have long wished to ask you something." "Please do," she said. "This," and he wrote the initial letters, WYA:ICNB, DYMTON. These letters meant, when you answered, "It cannot be," did you mean then or never, unquote. It seemed impossible that she, Kitty, would be able to understand this complicated sentence, which was just composed of the initial letters. "I understand," she said, blushing. "What word is that?" he said, pointing to the N, which stood for never. Obviously, we're dealing here with a Constance Garnett translation, not with the initial Russian of Tolstoy. "The word is never," she said, "but that is not true." He quickly erased what he had written, handed her the chalk, and rose. She wrote, "ICNAOT." His face brightened subtly. He had understood. It meant, "I could not answer otherwise then." And so it continues. What Vygotsky is trying to say here is that in words we can capture our deepest thoughts and meanings, ones which otherwise we would have a great deal of difficulty communicating. And if a person is really on the same wavelength as someone else, even a trigger, even the opening letters, are enough to tell you what's on that person's mind. So it really is it's a window into consciousness and into the feeling life and thoughts and intentions and attitudes of other people. As I said, Vygotsky began as a student of aesthetics. His doctoral thesis was on the psychology of art. And unlike Piaget, who seems never to have been very touched by anything artistic, that gives depth to his writing, which is, I think, quite remarkable. In the few minutes remaining, I want to mention very briefly Vygotsky's prize student and a great psychologist in his own right, Alexander Luria, who was born just 6 years after Piaget and Vygotsky, but not being a genius in the same sense, being more of a Beethoven than a Mozart, always saw himself as a student and as somebody who was really completing Vygotsky's work more than really carrying out his own. One of the most disappointing stories I have to tell about myself was in 1966, I was in the former Soviet Union, then the Soviet Union, and I ran into a friend of mine who was at the Bolshoi Ballet, and he said, "I'm going to see Luria tomorrow morning, would you like to come?" And I said, without moments of hesitation, "No, I'd much rather sleep." All I can say in my defense is I really didn't know who Luria was, but it would have been a great thing to have met Luria, who did speak some English and other European languages, but instead I chose to sleep, and I always tell my children, don't turn down opportunities like that because you may never have another chance. And sure enough, he died some years later. Luria was more involved with psychoanalysis and with the emotional life than Vygotsky. And his early work was, in fact, about how do we measure people's emotions, for example, by how they squeeze a bulb or what their skin response is like. And he never lost interest in a direct measure of motivation and emotionality. He also became much more interested in the brain than Vygotsky was. He was a major neuropsychologist who studied what happened to individuals after various forms of brain damage. I think both he and Vygotsky gets some early interest in the brain, but during the Second World War, being a psychologist was completely taboo in the Soviet Union. Stalin basically wanted to kill all the psychologists. So Luria took a second degree in medicine, became a doctor, and worked on a unit with people who suffered trauma during war, people who had bullet wounds or shrapnel wounds, and there he became a major contributor to neuropsychology. His most well-known empirical demonstration within developmental psychology was a Vygotskian kind of demonstration that speech undergoes a number of transformations in the course of early childhood, and where speech becomes interesting is when it isn't simply a reaction to what other people say or a rote repetition, but rather a way of regulating your own behavior. And we ran into this when I pointed out that according to Vygotsky, when kids mutter, they aren't just making sounds, they're actually trying to tell themselves what to do. And Luria carried out a group of quite ingenious studies where he showed that initially, when you say things to kids, you just get an immediate reflexive reaction, but eventually the meanings of the words become dominant. And probably the best example of this is the game Simon Says, where when you say Simon Says, you're supposed to go and imitate what the model does, but if you simply say do this, you're not supposed to imitate what the model does. But Luria showed that until kids were 3 or 4 years of age, language always had an impelling effect. So whether you said do this, or Simon Says, or even say don't do this, the kids would still do it. So language there had just a stimulating effect. But when the meaning came to dominate, like stop or don't do this, then the child would no longer use language impellingly, but rather language as a way of regulating his behavior and using his own language to regulate his own behavior in that kind of egocentric speech sense, and eventually using language to influence the behavior of other people. Fourth example under Luria was that he and Vygotsky became very interested in whether what we would now call preliterate people, what was then called in a politically incorrect way primitive people, thought differently than did people who'd been to school. This is an unschooled, schooled kind of question. And so they got the very ingenious idea of going to look at peasants in Uzbekistan and showing them illusions, geometric illusions. A very famous geometric illusion is the Muller-Lear illusion, where you have two lines which are actually the same size, but to people who live in a geometric environment, this looks longer, this line looks longer than this line. Anyway, they went out to Uzbekistan, and Luria wired back, that was the mode of, the pre-email mode of of communication, that the Uzbekis have no illusions, because, in fact, they didn't see this line is longer than this. They saw it as exactly the same because they were not part of what's called a carpenter environment. It was a funny thing to quote because in English, as in Russian as in English, the word illusions doesn't just apply to geometric illusions. It also applies to any kind of mistaken notion. Unfortunately for Luria and Vygotsky, though perhaps not surprising in retrospect, they were punished for this research because it was suggesting that people from higher social classes think better than people from lower social classes, and the whole notion of class society was a very evil thing in Soviet Russia. One should get rid of classes, and so they learned quite brutally that they were not supposed to do this kind of research at all. And I've already mentioned that Luria did not have the brilliance, the initial prodigious brilliance of Vygotsky, but in many ways he carried the mission forward. He regularized it, he systematized it, he made many of the writings available. And we would not know about Vygotsky in the way that we did, that we do, if it hadn't been for Luria's work. Luria was also friendly with many Western psychologists who are still alive. When I was a student, he was always being rumored to come to conferences, but he almost never came. This was not because he wouldn't come, it's because he wasn't allowed to come. So even though he wasn't under house arrest, in the same way as Eisenstein. He never really had the freedom that he wanted to do what he wanted to do. A few critique remarks about Vygotsky. Vygotsky didn't know much about infancy. Again, Piaget's books about infancy hadn't come out yet, and so he didn't have any real knowledge about it. Also, he didn't think about what it is that the child comes, the infant comes equipped with on Earth, and that was another difficulty for his theory, because in a way you can't be a developmentalist if you don't make assumptions about the initial equipment. Piaget, as you will recall, just gives functional invariance, as he calls it, assimilation and accommodation. He doesn't provide any content. Many modern thinkers provide a lot of content, a lot of ideas already built in to the child's mind. Vygotsky did not engage this issue. Vygotsky was aware that physical tools, you know, the saw and the wrench, are not the same as knots to remind you to pick up milk on the way home, or lines in the paper to tell you what to shop with. But he never really was able to clarify just what was the difference between these two kinds of mediators. Mediators are things which help you to do things which are important to you between yourself and the physical environment. So he didn't really work out the relationship between the more physical tools and the more psychological tools. The studies he carried out were pretty primitive. We don't have any real data on how many subjects were investigated, and we have no statistics about the differences between conditions. We just have informal reports. That was of the time. Even Piaget's reporting would never pass muster today, but there is an interesting difference between Piaget and Vygotsky, and it is a really important difference, and that is that Piaget's findings replicate remarkably well. If you do what Piaget did, you will almost always get the same results. Much less true for Vygotsky and Luria, which makes us think there was more special pleading, if not fudging, in their data. And it gives Piaget a claim to being a scientist. Indeed, I would have given him the Nobel Prize in a way that I don't think Luria. Luria gets the Nobel Prize for being a great thinker, not for being a great scientist. Another kind of unfair critique of Vygotsky is that nowadays he would have been asked about situational cognition, namely the extent to which knowledge embeds in various situations rather than being something which can be decontextualized. The ultimate situationalist believes that we don't do anything in complete indifference to the situation in which we found ourselves. And anybody, if they're put into a remote enough situation, will not be able to make use of knowledge which they allegedly have. I think perhaps the right thing to say here is that Vygotsky would have had to take a position vis-a-vis the situationalists, because they probably would have claimed him as one of their own. And yet my own thinking, because of his own writing about decontextualization and about mediation, internalization, means that he would have felt that we all start out as situationalists, but we don't end up there. But since he didn't live, we don't really know what he would have had to say. Finally, and to end on an up note, Piaget has a lot to say that's useful for education, but you've got to do the extrapolation. He didn't do it himself. Vygotsky, either because he really cared about education or because he lived in a society which was expected to show the utility of what he did, provided a lot of useful and interesting notions for education, like the zone of proximal development, scaffolding, mediation, and so on. And he also put forth a very interesting problem, the relationship between scientific and spontaneous concepts, which I still think raises the most profound questions for what we do in school. How do we know we're successful, and how do you relate early intuitions and early street or spontaneous knowledge to the much more systematized but also decontextualized knowledge that takes place in a schoolroom, just like the one that we meet in twice a week.